As was mentioned, my name is Matt. I have the privilege of being the minister here. So if we've not met, let me add welcome to you. Great to have you with us. We're spending, as of today, 6 Sundays looking at prayer. We're looking at prayer for a little while. And very simply, if you want to put a simple definition on it, prayer is communicating with God. You might think of it as sitting by your bed with your hands together as you go to sleep. And that's a great thing. But there is a lot more to prayer than that. And we're going to be sort of looking at prayer from different angles through this series. We're doing this around a structure of the who, what, where, why, when, and how of prayer. Okay? So today is the when. In other words, when do you pray? When does it happen? There's a fairly well-known book that came out in the 80s called Too Busy Not to Pray. Is it any good? I don't know. I've never had time to read it. In the 36 years since it came out, I've never opened a copy. There's one in our church library, but I haven't got around to it. I just haven't got around to reading it. I could read it any time, but therefore it's not a priority. It's there. And I think that sometimes the same thing happens with prayer itself. It's literally something you can do any time. You don't need anything to pray. And so often I think we just don't get around to it. Is it just me, or is that other people too? And let's face it, in modern life, we're busy. And our busyness is perhaps the biggest obstacle we have in our spiritual lives. But busyness is more than just an annoying thing that happens. I did some research on this. Someone called Dr. Susan Coven, who practices in internal medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital, writes this. She says, "In the past few years, I've observed an epidemic of sorts. Patient after patient suffering from the same condition. The symptoms of this condition include fatigue, irritability, insomnia, anxiety, headaches, heartburn, bowel disturbances, back pain and weight gain. There are no blood tests or x-ray diagnostics of this condition, and yet it's easy to recognize. The condition is excessive busyness." Also, the researcher Tim Kreider argues that overly busy people are busy because of, he says, their own ambition or drive or anxiety. Because they're addicted to busyness and fear, what they might have to face in its absence. They feel anxious and guilty when they aren't either working or doing something to promote their work. Busyness serves as a kind of existential reassurance, a hedge against emptiness. And he suggests that our culture has assumed a value position that says that stopping is a bad thing. But as he puts it, stopping is not just a holiday, an indulgence or a vice. It is as indispensable to the brain as vitamin D is to the body. And deprived of it, we suffer a mental affliction as disfiguring as rickets. We struggle to stop being busy. But why do we do this to ourselves? The great philosopher Soren Kierkegaard once wrote, "The unhappy man is always absent from himself, never present to himself." Obsessing over the future, keeping frenetically busy with an eye on some far-off date, is a way of distracting ourselves from present reality. By refusing to truly engage with the big important questions in our lives, keeping engagement with God at arm's length, many of us settle for living a busy life rather than a rich one. Now, our problem, of course, is probably what I've said so far. You might think, yeah, I can see something with that. But we set expectations for a busy life as a culture, not as individuals. You can't suddenly decide one morning to opt out of everything that's expected of you as a parent or an employee or a friend. And the expectations of modern life keep getting bigger. Get on top of your email and you'll find that people send you more of them. Figure out how to spend enough time with your kids and do a good job at work, and you'll suddenly feel a new social pressure to spend more time exercising or cultivating a hobby or locating ethically sourced vegetables. There's always too much to do, isn't there? Tell me this is not just me. Thanks, John. I wonder if you have busyness addiction. Here are some of the signs of it. One is that your diary is always full. When you're addicted to busyness, you will constantly find your calendar, whether it's written or in your head, full of tasks that have to be done. If you manage to find any empty space, you will compulsively look for activities to do. When you don't have anything to do, you will instantly feel like you're unnecessarily wasting time. Another one is that everyone says you're busy. Do your loved ones tell you that you're always busy? Do your family or friends complain you've got no time for them? An obvious sign of being a busyness addict is when other people tell you you're too busy. However, sometimes our loved ones might not want to criticize us or bother us when we're busy with our schedules. So maybe it's a good thing to ask your friends and family, how do I come across? Do I look busy? It may also be that slowing down is difficult for you. Is the process of slowing down, even for a few hours, a challenge for you? Is it hard or even scary to stop? If so, you might just be addicted to being busy. But despite what I've said so far, here's a surprising truth. You are probably not as busy as you think you are. Sorry, Antoinette, you're exasperated by that. On average, the research says people do have more free time than in previous generations. People spend more time with their children than parents did 40 years ago, despite a prevailing sense that they're not. So why doesn't it feel that way? Researchers have observed something that's been called toxic time. This is when we worry about we should be seeing our children more maybe when we're at work, or we worry about work when we're seeing our friends. And maybe we want to do more exercise or work longer to get something finished, but we feel guilt about something else we should be doing. Time slips away in a relentless concern that we should be somewhere else doing something more, or that we're just not able to get on top of all the things that we'd hoped to. We have been led to believe in our culture that we should be able to do and have everything, and then we constantly feel guilty that we haven't. In other words, often we think that we're busy, but actually we're just anxious. Often we think that we're busy, but actually we're just anxious. Humans are, it turns out, bad judges of how we spend our time. Eric Heltzer, a social psychologist, researched what people do, and he says, if you look at the ingredients of a satisfying life, what our data shows is that people are shortchanging themselves in the areas that may be most important. The lesson is that you have to be intentional in carving out the time you want for the things that you want. Even though we have the time, we don't tend to use it in a mindful way. So busyness is bad for everybody. I suspect there's no debate there. But the person that's likely squeezed out most from our lives when we're busy is God. The church leader and author Rich Vioda says this: our souls were not created for the kind of speed to which we have grown accustomed. Thus we're a people out of rhythm. We are worn out. In all of this, the problem before us is not just the frenetic pace we live at, but what gets pushed out from our lives as a result. That is life with God. There's a great story in Luke's gospel, an eyewitness account of Jesus' life, where Jesus meets two friends, Mary and Martha, and we get to see the problem of busyness in a way that I think just sounds so true of modern life. So just a short story, here it is. As Jesus and his disciples were on their way, he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. She had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. She came to him and asked, Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me. Martha, Martha, the Lord answered, you are worried and upset about many things, but few things are needed, or indeed only one. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her. Now, Jesus was regarded as a rabbi, a teacher. That's why Mary sits at his feet. Men would have done that too in that culture. But the point of the story is to show us the different approaches of these two women. Culturally, it was important to prepare the home for a guest. Martha's not wrong there. But it's become the main thing. She is so busy, so focused on getting ready for Jesus, that she misses Jesus. Sounds really simple and even silly, doesn't it? She's so busy getting ready anxiously preparing for Jesus, she misses Jesus. Let's have a little look at some of the points of what's going on with her. So what do we see come out of her in this story? Well, one thing is she is irritable, it seems, especially with spiritual people. She's working. She's not doing anything. She's talking, spending time with Jesus. She doesn't want to work. So Martha's irritated with her. She feels, no one cares about me. I'm grafting, I'm getting on. The other people are not doing it. No, what about me? Anyone ever been that person? Yes. She's angry at God. She probably doesn't even recognize this about herself, I would say. She thinks that she's doing all this for God, but really it seems the heart thing is she's trying to justify herself to those around her. She even takes to ordering Jesus around. That's not a good idea, generally speaking. Come on, Jesus, you need to tell her. She should be a bit more like me. She feels taken advantage of, and what's really sad is it's not getting her the very thing that at heart she really wants and needs, which is closeness to God. The irony is that access to God is freely given, but she doesn't think that Jesus cares for her in her situation. And basically what she's done in this story is she has imagined Jesus to be something less than he is. In other words, she's turned him into an idol. Once this has happened, it seems reasonable for her to take all the burdens of the world onto herself. You know, I need to do this to impress Jesus, to make him comfortable, all these things. I've got to do these things for him to make him okay, and then everything will be good. She's got into this thinking somehow. Anybody ever done that one? But look how he responds. Firstly, with gentleness. He does not get angry back. He doesn't condemn her. He acknowledges her emotions. Secondly, he brings an invitation. He makes it clear, you know, I want to spend time with you, not just have you do stuff for me. I want to spend time with you. Don't just run around. And then thirdly, he gives an example. He points to what Mary is doing. Not to say, Mary's top of the class, but to say, you think that what Mary's doing is a problem because she's not helping with the practical stuff. But actually, all I'm looking for is for you to hang out with me, to spend time with me. That's why I'm in your house. That's why I'm here. Let's just do that. And so in this story, we get a comfort and a challenge. We don't need to do anything to impress God, but are we actually willing to step back from the activity that we would legitimize by saying we're doing it for God in order to actually spend time with God? Moving to today, the world's a different place. We've got phones and social media and all sorts of other pressures. How do we find the time and, more importantly, the motivation to spend time with God? How do we make the space to pray with the pressure to do surrounding us all the time? Here's a little snapshot of how Jesus found time to pray. How did he do it? When did he do it? Sprinkled through the Gospels, the four accounts of his life, there is a subtle but recurring pattern. Look at this. Rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. That's in Mark chapter 1. Mark 6, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida while he dismissed the crowd. After leaving them, he went up on a mountainside to pray. Luke 4, at daybreak, Jesus went out to a solitary place. Luke 6, one of those days, Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray and spent the night praying to God. Matthew 14, when Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. Hearing of this, the crowd followed him on foot from the towns. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them and healed their sick. John 6, after the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world. Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. In each of these examples, one thing is consistent. Jesus always goes off to pray alone when he's busy. He's never just sat around doing nothing and then suddenly thinks, I think I might just go and pray for a bit. There are huge demands on his time. People want to see him. They want to talk to him. They want him to heal them. And these are not bad things. It's not that Jesus is choosing to pray rather than watch TV. These are real human beings for whom he has compassion. They want his time. And Jesus still disappears to pray. There's a great integrity to what he said to Martha, isn't there? Let me put it to you. Jesus is not just busy. The demands on his time are more important than anything that you or I are doing, and yet getting away to pray is still a regular priority for him. We're not doing anything that's as important as what Jesus was doing with his time, and he still gets away to pray. Now, you might be thinking, okay, I get that too much busyness is bad for me, okay? But why not just chill out? Why does prayer need to be a big deal? Especially if you're visiting today, you wouldn't identify as a follower of Jesus. You might think, yeah, I totally get this, the need to switch off work and doing stuff. But why would I use that time to pray of all things? Why not just do the very fashionable thing and practice mindfulness? They're good questions if you're asking them. Why pray rather than pursue mindfulness? Well, mindfulness, as I say, it's very fashionable at the moment. It is quite a vague word, though, I think. It can mean a lot of things, but for the most part, it seems to mean stopping, being still, being present in the moment, being aware of yourself, breathing deeply, things like that. And it's not that that's bad. That, no, for the most part, that doesn't seem to be too bad. But there's a number of things that praying does that are greater than what mindfulness will do for you. Let me tell you what they are. Firstly, prayer has a greater effect on fighting anxiety. In Philippians 4 in the New Testament, it says, "Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God." In other words, the alternative to anxiety is prayer. Probably sounds good. Does that actually work? Well, a new study published by the Sociology of Religion journal suggests that prayer can help ease people's anxiety, but, and this is really interesting, whether prayer eases your anxiety depends on the personality of the God that you believe in. That is, if you believe God to be angry, vengeful, constantly disappointed with you, or loving and inviting, determines whether prayer brings more relief or more stress. Guess which one brings more relief? When God is as he is described in the Bible, then prayer brings relief. A 2005 study in the Journal of Behavioral Medicine compared secular and spiritual forms of meditation, and they found that spiritual meditation, particularly prayer, was more calming. Researchers found that the group that practiced prayer showed greater decreases in anxiety and stress and a more positive mood. Apparently, people who prayed also tolerated discomfort or pain almost twice as long when asked to put their hand in an ice water bath. Don't feel you need to do that, though. Don't know why they did that. Anyway. Also, prayer draws us specifically closer to God. In ancient Buddhist meditation, the goal is simply to empty the mind, to empty the self. But Christian prayer is to make room for the filling of God. In modern mindfulness, the goal is to be present in the moment. In prayer, the goal is simply to be present to God's presence. The philosopher and author Dallas Willard says, "Our part in practicing the presence of God is to direct our minds to him. This may well be challenged by our burdensome habits of dwelling on things less than God, but these habits can be broken." He's saying the discipline of focusing our minds on God is challenging and does have to be developed over time, but it can be done. In James 4 in the New Testament, it says, "Draw near to God and he will draw near to you." The promise is, he's there, but you have to want it. That's always the critical thing. You have to want it. Prayer also contextualizes our lives. St. Benedict, a 6th century monk, said, "Day by day, remind yourself that you're going to die." But he was a barrel of laughs, wasn't he? Now, that might feel very heavy, but when we pray, we reorientate ourselves to reality. We remember who God is and who we are. what he's responsible for, what we're responsible for. This life will come and go, but we find our place and our peace when we're positioned in reference to our Creator, when we see what's our responsibility and what's his. Next, prayer is long-term in its life-changing effects. Mindfulness has its benefits, but it does not tend to enhance a person's love for other people. David Bennett, a psychologist, writes this. It's an amazing quote. He says, "Meditating on God's love has done more to increase my love than decades of effort to try to be more loving. Allowing myself to deeply experience his love, taking time to soak it in and allow it to infuse me, has begun to affect changes that I had given up hope of ever experiencing. A day-to-day walk with God expressed in prayer changes people. It might not make you better than the person next to you, but it makes you a better version of what you would be without it. Prayer also makes us face our deepest issues. The great scientist and committed Christian Blaise Pascal said, all of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone. In context, Pascal was thinking not just about being silent, but about prayer. And what I think he was getting at is that we sometimes avoid prayer because it forces us to grapple with our problems. I don't know about you, but when I sit down to pray on my own, my mind quickly goes to all those things that are painful or things about myself that I need to change. And I like avoiding those things, don't you? But in prayer, we encounter a person who deeply loves us and knows us and is the ultimate place to express and deal with those difficult things. We're worried about getting too close to God, about having to get out on the table all these hard things in our lives. But he's the best place to take them. And finally, prayer brings the greatest reward. Jesus once said this, "When you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by others. Truly I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen. Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you." In that time, religious people would pray for show. They'd make sure people could see them. They'd be like, "Hey everyone, look, I'm praying, look at me, I'm really spiritual." The reward they were looking for was the respect of other people. And they got it. And that's why Jesus says, well, they've received their reward. That's the thing they wanted for what they're doing. They've got it. There you go. But those who pray when there's nobody to impress, Jesus says, will be rewarded. What's the reward? It's God himself. It's all the things we just listed and many more. And that's why it's only when we see God as the reward that prayer becomes authentic and something that we actually want to do rather than feel that we should do or we have to do. When we see God himself and knowing him as the reward. As I finish talking, let's get practical with this. How do I find the space and motivation to pray in the chaos of modern life? Here's a few things. Firstly, honestly assess where your time actually goes. Here's something insanely practical that you could do. Take an average week, it won't work with a weird week, take an average week and divide it up into 15-minute chunks. I know that sounds like a lot of effort, but you probably only need to do it once. And write down what you actually do with every 15 minutes of the week. Is it what you thought? Is it what you actually wanted to do? Were you achieving anything or just fretting? Were you actually busy? And you might be. Or were you just controlled by anxiety? Or were you genuinely busy, but actually using that busyness to avoid engaging with reality and the deeper things in your life? Next, consider what you really want to spend your time on. Many of us have too much going on to add Jesus into our rhythm of life, to add prayer into our busy schedules. At the end of the day, the question is, do we want it? If you want to spend time with God, make some changes, prioritize, live a different rhythm. But at the end of it, whatever tips and ideas and approaches there are, it always comes down to, do you want it or not? God wants you, not your busyness. But do you want him? Is continuous activity something that just feels safer and easier to you? Or do you want to be close to God? Does activity feel like it's a tangible way to be able to say to God, look, I've done stuff, in essence, to justify yourself before God. You know, I've done this, I've done that, I've done this, like Martha did. Does it seem like a more efficient and practical way of living than sitting at Jesus' feet and learning and speaking to him? Next, embrace the power of habit. Developing a habit is what helps. Just like exercise or reading or brushing your teeth, habits develop when you put the effort in at the beginning. Lots of people don't develop a habit of prayer because at the beginning it feels weird or boring. But like most habits, it gets better and pays off over time. We live in a culture where if something is not instantly gratifying, we can't be bothered. We are not in the habit of developing habits resiliently. But most things that are worth doing in life take time to develop. A meaningful prayer life is one of them. And finally, don't let the guilt of not praying stop you from praying. There's a massive temptation, if you're a Christian and you know God loves you and you know in theory he's worth your time, to turn prayer into an arduous task, like an act of required devotion that you do because on some level, if you're really honest about it, you just feel like you have to. Prayer becomes a task, not a relationship. And what happens when it's like that is maybe we don't pray for a bit, and then because we feel guilty, we sort of keep swerving it. We keep steering clear. We don't go back to it. But that misses what God is like. God is a Father who always wants to hear from you. On the cross, Jesus dealt with your apathy, your laziness, your priority of entertainment over a vibrant spiritual life, your frenetic activity. And so God is totally accessible to you, not waiting to condemn you for your poor attendance. And really finally, because I said finally a minute ago when it wasn't finally, but actually finally, find the place of joy, whatever it is. There are lots of ways to pray. And while it's good to have a go at various things and be exposed to different things, there'll probably be some ways of praying that you find easier than other ones. Don't beat yourself up. Just do those, if nothing else. So if you pray with more joy by the sea than at home, go to the sea. If praying in a group is helpful, find a group that you can do that with. If you like solitude when you pray, work that into your day or your week. It's better to pray at all than have some idealized prayer life that you're not doing and feel bad about. God would much rather you speak to him than feel bad all the time for when you didn't. So there's a few thoughts. If even one of these things is helpful, cool. But as we begin this series, I want to encourage you, be open to praying in new ways. But let's not idealize this too much. Whatever helps you pray, just do that. Don't overcomplicate it. But do you remember the last thing Jesus said to Martha? It was quite strange. He said, Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her. Those who choose what is better, Jesus over busyness, will not have what they've chosen taken away ever. Ever. He died to secure their place, our place. He's well worth our time.